Greetings, and welcome to Research on Religion, a weekly podcast series devoted to the social scientific study of religion. I'm Anthony Gill, your host, professor of political science at the University of Washington, and distinguished senior fellow at Baylor University's Institute for Studies of Religion, the gracious sponsor of our podcast. We encourage you to visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org to post comments, ask questions, access additional material related to today's program, and to find out what is happening at the Institute. All right, let's begin.
New York City, the Big Apple, the city that never sleeps. Gotham, Empire City, the city so nice you have to say it twice, because after all, it's up to you. New York, New York. Bum, 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 bum. What do you think of when I mention New York City? The Yankees? Broadway musicals? Times Square's on New Year's Eve? The Wall Street stock market? Maybe you recall the World Trade Center attack. Or perhaps your thoughts run to the city being the media capital of the world, spearheaded by the New York Times and the three major television networks located there. Chances are, though, religion is probably not the first thing that pops into your mind. After all, we are supposedly living in a time when the public square is becoming increasingly secularized and more people are listing none as their preferred religious affiliation. These secularizing trends are purported to be happening most rapidly in our large urban areas on the East and West Coasts. New York would certainly fit that bill. Large urban city, check. And on the East Coast, double check. But what if I told you that New York City remains a vibrant home to a multiplicity of religious traditions? We are rediscovering this fact thanks to the efforts of today's guest, Tony Carnes, who is the editor and publisher of A Journey Through New York City Religions, a multimedia project that is literally walking through the streets of Gotham, documenting all the minute details of spiritual life in the big city. Tony is an award-winning journalist who serves as a senior staff writer for Christianity Today and is the co-editor of several books including New York Glory, Religions in the City with Anna Karpathakis and Asian American Religions, The Making and Remaking of Borders and Boundaries with Fengang Yang, a scholar who I happen to know. We will put links up to these books on our website and, as always, urge you to stop by and peruse them. There is certainly much more to his lengthy biography, but I will let Tony fill in those details as they are important to understanding how he came to the point of this fascinating anthropological project. Tony, welcome to Research on Religion.
Good to be with you. West Coast Tony.
West Coast Tony, yes. We have two Tonys here, so it's going to be a little confusing today. It's almost like talking to myself, but you're East Coast Tony, and I am West Coast Tony. I notice you have a little bit of an accent, though. Where does that accent come from?
Kicked around a lot of places in the world, but probably the underlying accent is from Texas.
From Texas? That is interesting, because that's what I want to ask you a little bit now and talk about your project. Your project, A Journey Through New York City Religions, and we'll post a link up to your website on our website so people can view it. This is a major undertaking that you've been doing for, I would guess, about 3 years now. I think you started this project in July of 2010. Is that correct?
That's correct.
And it was thanks to support from something known as the Values Research Institute. We'll talk about that a little bit. And it involves a number of related activities, including the Journey Data Center, Journey Consulting, and the Design and Journey Workshops. Every project like this always has a backstory, and I consider it to be important for understanding its origins and purpose to get a sense of that backstory, including the people involved in it. So I want to start with a little bit of your history first. We know you have a Texas accent, but tell us a little bit about your spiritual background and where you grew up.
Well, I come from Central Texas. I was born in a small town in Central Texas called Fredericksburg, Texas, and lived in ranch country. And then my parents moved to bigger towns, and we eventually ended up into a very small city or a very large town on the Gulf Coast. I grew up, my parents' family were Methodist, but I grew up with, you might say, as hot rodding as a religious category.
Hot rodding, uh-huh.
Hot rodding and surfing. And I won't say I was a hot rodder, though I had a pretty hot car, but you know, like a lot of kids on the move, in this case, all over Texas, moving from ranch country, small towns, to bigger towns, to cities, you were really trying to make your way, not fit your parents' category, a teenager who up to teenager things, but as something entirely different. So I really, on Sundays, I'd like to do hot rodding and surfing. And so that was my religious categories growing up.
I have to ask you now, though, and this is a question curious to me. You grew up in small town Texas. I grew up in essentially a outskirts of Milwaukee in Wisconsin, and then moved to a smaller town. You're not living in New York City, correct?
Mm-hmm.
How does small town Texas Tony fit in with big town New York City? Because personally, I've been to New York City twice. Couldn't stand living there.
Mm-hmm. Oh well, it's probably we need to introduce you to New York that we know, and you might change your mind. I always liked New York. When I was growing up as a kid, we took some trips to New York when I was in elementary school. And I remember being fascinated by, my parents asked me what I wanted to do. And I said, well, I want to go on a subway. So one day my mom and I went on a subway all the way out to Coney Island and back. And I just thought that was great. I found out that at that time it was pretty safe on the streets of New York. And so I would go out and venture from the hotel and ask the concierge, you know, where are the best restaurants and the hot dog stands to go to?
Yeah.
And would go off on my own. My sister got to go to the more, she was older, so she got to go to places I couldn't go. So my parents asked me, well, where do you want to go? And I'd already done my homework of what was the best restaurant in town. That was the Four Seasons. So, well, they particularly wanted to do that, but they said, okay, we'll go there. And then in New York won my heart at the Four Seasons. The restaurant, the waiter asked what I want, and I asked for my favorite sandwich, peanut butter and jelly sandwich. And my parents said, oh, no, he doesn't want to order that. But the waiter won my heart and told me that I really, New York is a great place to be, because he said, there's no problem with that. What kind of jelly do you want, sir?
Wow.
And what it means is that New York's a great place to realize all sorts of things. In that case, you can have at that time, an $8 peanut butter and sandwich, a jelly sandwich in the best restaurant in town. And if you need a Texas jelly, they would provide it. And I thought, this is my kind of town. And then I went over to a radio program run by two Texans. They sang the Eyes of Texas, or Bonio. And I thought, well, this is just like North Dallas, you know. It's not so far from Texas. So I always loved New York and felt very comfortable coming here several decades ago. And
Actually, let's pick up your story. So we found out you visited New York as a kid. You got a peanut butter and jelly sandwich, listened to some Texas radio disc jockeys. That's pretty cool. But we left off as a teenager hot rodding somewhere on the East Coast of the United States. Tell us a little bit more about your own spiritual journey and then also how you got into journalism.
In college, my senior year in college, I was really looking for something deeper and more meaningful in life. And I'd been real active in politics and stuff, and I saw that actually, whatever was good about politics, it didn't fill the heart and certainly could let you down. People, you know, in politics, people could lie to you.
No. That's not what we teach our students in political science here. It could happen, yeah.
Yeah, it could happen. And so I started, a friend of mine asked me to go to a meeting on campus at University of Texas, and I went, and I didn't know really who they were and what they were doing, but I did notice a freshness of spirit and I hadn't come across. And it turned out it was an evangelical Christian meeting, and I, through a series of events, became a Christian, and then I thought, well, what am I going to do now? I have so many ideas, and how do I think in a way that, how do I bring my newfound faith into my thought and life? And somebody also gave me a book by Francis Schaeffer called Escape from Reason. And I said, yes, that's a lot of things I've been thinking. And so I wrote him in Switzerland and asked if I could come. And he said, come. So I went out there to Le Bris in Switzerland. That was the name of their place in Switzerland. And stayed there for a couple months and really did grow intellectually quite a bit and spiritually. And then got some money to do a project in Spain and moved to Madrid, a big city, and then to London. And spiritual life was put me on a journey. I didn't feel, I personally did not feel very distant from Texas. And I'm not one of those that, I saw that there's certain things that you need to leave Texas to get, but I wasn't like many Texans came to New York or came from the Midwest or someplace in rejection of their hometown, saying it was narrow and parochial. That wasn't my experience. I didn't leave from rejection. I left because I wanted to explore new things. And my experience as also maybe as a becoming a Christian was that when I was fairly secular, even though I did a lot of things, I was very narrow in a lot of ways. I wasn't very adventuresome, at least in my definition. If I didn't like something, I didn't really pay much attention to it. But becoming a Christian was actually sort of like an opening of the world to me.
Mm-hmm.
I started liking arts a lot more. I started liking other types of music a lot more. I started interested in a lot of people. And it didn't happen fast enough for me, really, look at all the world, because for me, my conversion was, in that sense, leaving my own parochialism, which was my own self-created parochialism, to becoming much more cosmopolitan. And mm-hmm. So my later on, when I first studied as a sociologist, and then started in political science, but I decided I wanted to look at more aspects of society than just politics.
Yeah, us political scientists are a little narrow, so.
Well, it's a specialty.
It is a specialty, and I consider myself more of a sociologist than economist, so you can knock political science.
That's a good observation. I added economics to the, and so I said, well, I'll study political economy, at least the way I defined it, which was combining politics and economics. And then I discovered that really I had a bigger view, and that I thought there were more factors than just those power and or politics and economics. And when I was in China, and I'm going to skip a little bit here because you're asking also how I got into journalism. And part of me becoming a Christian is that I open up the world, but I did ask the question, says, well, I believe the world works this way because I'm in the Western world, and of course, it seems to match the way that Christianity teaches, because the Western world is so influenced by Christianity. So maybe I need an outside perspective. And so I started looking around at other countries to take a look. And compare what I had begun to believe and think and see if it held up other places. So I ended up in China. And in 19, 1990s, I was working on a television project in China to create a television network in China. Actually, the first television network and the only television network a foreigner has ever been allowed to set up in China.
That's pretty cool.
And it was called Windows on the World. And and I noticed that the China I was seeing was a lot different than what I saw being reported. And that is, I got that very early, even before the 90s. I'd been there before. But China was changing so rapidly, and though it was an authoritarian government, there was a great deal of freedom in everyday life to talk about all sorts of things and to do all sorts of things. And also, being a American, I had a lot more freedom to move around. And I discovered that I thought, well, there's a lot of dynamism here, and it's just like exploding, even though it's still, you know, a lot of it's under the surface, economically, explosion, political, and so forth. And I guess this really, I just thought there was a lot going on. So 1980s, I guess it was, and early 90s. And a friend of mine said, well, why don't you write an article about what's going on? Because they, I found an article on the establishment of a Department of Religion within Beijing University and for Christianity Today. And I thought, you know, I can do this. I can get sources pretty well. I can get them to talk. I can get the documents. I know how to do that. But I don't really, I wasn't a very good writer. But I thought, you know, well, that's half the issue. So maybe I should, do this. So I started doing some reporting and, with various, outlets and Christianity Today and Wall Street Journal and other outlets, and I liked it, and it was more immediate, allowed me to explore a lot of a very dynamic reality, while a scholarly pace might be not fit that particular reality so much, at least when it's changing a lot.
Mm-hmm.
And so I became, I started saying I like journalism a lot. And then, in 2004, I started to see that I really liked the writing for the journalistic market better than anything. And so I started thinking about that. And I was writing a lot more. I did a huge number of articles in this period. And I started looking for, and I liked religion reporting because I was doing religion projects.
Mm-hmm.
And I looked around to, and I thought that, I worked on some projects with the New York Times on faith in the city, and I, as a consultant, and or you should say an expert that they interview, and I started to think that, there's a lot more to be said about what's happening in New York City about than the newspapers and the TV stations and other magazines are doing or have time to do. And
that brings us up to the project, A Journey Through New York Religions. Right. And as I listen to your background, I can see that you are just ideally suited for this. You're somebody who is intellectually curious. You've traveled all over the place. You're asking questions and continually exploring new things. And so I'm going to point people again back to the website. Check our website out. We'll link back to it because it is a panoply of different experiences. There's videos, there's recordings, there's articles, there's pictures. It's a really interesting
anthropological experiment or experience, I should say. How did you get involved doing this? And it's associated with something called the Values Research Institute, which you're the president of. How did that thing get started, and how is this connected to the Journey Through New York Religions?
Yes, real briefly, Values Research Institute, which was known as the International Research Institute on Values Changes, and we shortened the name to Values Research Institute.
It is easier to pronounce, yeah.
Yeah. And we were formed to track faith and social and political change in the former Soviet Union and in China. And it was a social science project. And we did many, many surveys there and in New York and other places in the United States. As we followed immigrants from those places, we started doing, surveys of them and producing articles and two books out of some of the project, including the one with Feng Ganyang on Asian American religion in 2004. And it was exciting, and it was a tremendous time of change and religious change going on. And I also noted the same thing as we followed the immigrants into New York City, that there's this wave of religious change going on in New York. And I wanted to cover that in more detail capturing this change and this excitement that these religious groups are bringing to the city. And I felt like that was more of a journalistic project. But I got to say, I didn't know how to, other than a few articles, sometimes big articles, but I didn't know how that could be covered. And I worked with a group called ProPublica in 2009. And ProPublica was formed by some Wall Street Journal people who saw that with the changes and downsizing going on in the media industry, that investigative journalism and investigative journalists were being downsized because they're very expensive, and in many places were closing their investigative journalist units. So they thought they would create an online news investigation site and co-partner with other media organizations and be sort of like an outsourcer for investigative journalism. And it happened that one of their projects was looking at the question of whether patients in a hospital in New Orleans during Katrina, whether patients were euthanized in order to cut down the cost of moving them.
Mm.
And it happened that I had been assigned by Christianity Today to cover Katrina, and I had been in New Orleans, and I had visited the hospital and had photographed the dead bodies in the hospital and had interviewed medical personnel there. And it also turned out that this case and my photographs and became a front page photograph with a story about this hospital and the New York Times, and ProPublica decided they would hire Sherry Fink to continue this investigation, and she's a physician and reporter. And so my reporting for how the bodies were left and so forth formed the first couple of paragraphs of her report, and then they used some of my photos for their report. Now, what I discovered is that, and she won a Pulitzer Prize for that.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought they were very clever. They did how they did this. Up until this time, no online media organization ever won a Pulitzer Prize, because the Pulitzer Prize is given only to a print media.
Mm-hmm.
So what they did is, knowing that they knew this project was really a big, important project, they partnered with the New York Times. But they were very clever about it. They didn't just partner with the New York Times. They partnered with the New York Times Magazine. And so what happened is the Pulitzer Committee decided that it would give the Pulitzer Prize to the New York Times and ProPublica. Okay, so they got the Pulitzer, which I had a small role in, but I didn't win it. Sherry Fink won it. But they got the Pulitzer, but because the Pulitzer Committee decided for the first time they would award a Pulitzer to an online, they gave also Pulitzer separately to ProPublica. So they didn't win it just for being in the New York Times. They also won it for being an online website. I thought, well, that's clever. And furthermore, because they partnered with the New York Times Magazine, they became eligible for the National Magazine Award for Best Article, which they won. I thought, oh, that is very, very clever. And they it worked very well. They do great work, really, really first-class work. And so I asked some of the people that I said, you know, I'd like to do this for religion reporting, because religion reporters are at the bottom of the totem pole in many news organizations, and so they're first to be laid off, because news organizations don't seem to understand the importance of religion, or they don't think that it sells newspapers and doesn't build audience.
Right.
And I said, I thought, you know, maybe I could do the same thing ProPublica would do for religion reporting and do it for New York City, because I had this conundrum. I knew New York was a big, big story, that one of the five big stories in New York City was the growth of religion that's grown in New York faster than anything like it in the last 100 years. And I said, this is such a huge story, but I can't seem to get enough space for it. And and I think that also religion reporting is done, it's too rooted in an old paradigm that makes it sort of uninteresting and not very user-friendly.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, you know, ProPublica, maybe I can learn from them. So I took their business plan and started studying it, and by the fall of 2009, I knew that I wanted to do online, and I experimented with some constructing some websites, and that weren't very good. But I was playing around with it, and I was also learning, because I also saw there was this huge digital revolution that affected me, because I'd become part of it. You know, of course, we know that for your statistical programs like SPSS, you had to go essentially to many universities. You had to go to the engineering department to get them to read your cards.
Yep.
And you were always waiting in line, and usually you were the last in line. You ended up doing wee in the early hours of the morning when nobody's around. At least that's true at University of Texas. And and also that it was very cumbersome. And but then we got the PC versions of these statistical packages, and it became immense power in that small. And then you also had the ability to process photos with Adobe Photoshop and to process video. And then they came out of a set of cameras. I got an early digital camera. Really, I think the first really good digital camera that was a reasonable price, the Nikon 995. And I started to this helped satisfy a need. I realized my picture taking, like my writing, wasn't very good, and I needed a lot more practice. And digital allows you to practice a lot. And so I started learning that, and I was using these mini cassette recorders, which means you have all these little cassettes around, and they're awkward too. But then I got a digital recorder, and that really set me up. And then there was these mapping software that came out. Of course, MapInfo was a big one, but it's very cumbersome. There were other programs that were coming out that were made it much more easier. And there was a flood of then there were much better with WordPress and other platforms were being developed that were made it much easier to go online. And so all of these things came together, and I said, well, you know, I really want to learn about this. This is this is a revolution that's going on in news media, and it's in a lot of areas, and it's really going to be dynamic for some time, and it's going to allow me to do something. So I said, well, maybe I can do something. And so 2009, I started thinking and planning, and then 2010, in, we got really started. I hired somebody and started actually working on the project, getting it prepared. I don't remember exactly when the name came out, but by June of 2010, I thought we had a workable idea for a platform and had a name, and so we soft launched in June of 2010, and then in July 9th, 2010, we did a hard launch. That is, we connected the platform up, made it visible to the web, and we didn't know what the reception would be. We were also learning a lot as we go, and it turned out that very quickly, I saw that many levels that we were doing something that was unique and could be, although we were very small, it could be, it was unique and could be quite powerful and change people's minds. Our goal was, at some point our goal became that we wanted to change people's minds about New York City. That is, around the world, New York occupies space in people's minds. You can go to Mali and you'll see people with T-shirts in Mali with saying, I love New York.
Mm-hmm.
It has a very large, maybe the most influential city, or at least in many ways in the world. It occupies mind space. And what we wanted to do is, how about if that mind space, we could change that from seeing the city as Sodom and Gomorrah, or later iteration, the secular city. How about if we could change that and show that, look, this is not what New York is anymore. New York is shifted. You know, you guys on the West Coast sort of coined that in my 1890s, Joaquin Miller, who was came from New York, but he lived out in Berkeley area, San Francisco area. He wrote a book in the 1890s, his vision of New York, which was that it was a Sodom and Gomorrah
on
the Hudson. And in fact, he didn't like the newspapers either, because his vision of what was going to happen in New York was apocalyptic. He said, you know, what will happen at the end of ages is that the filth of the newspapers in New York will pour out as molten lead into the street, into the sea. And I, being a journalist, I find that sort of interesting. But many people in New York did become pretty terrible in the 70s and late 60s, 70s, and 80s. It was a terrible place. I mean, and nowadays it's hard to even comprehend how bad it was. I got here in the late 80s, the 70s, and the New York was, you know, for 10 blocks, you could walk in the South Bronx, and not one building was ungutted. Not one building was standing or was not touched by arson and crime. And you could walk 10 blocks and see not one intact building. And there was rubble all around. And the crime on the street, the walk I'm thinking of is that there were drug dealers in every block, and gangs. And for several of those blocks, the prostitutes were often addicted and were abused. Decided to dispense with formalities, and they skated naked down the street, and or at least with only a shirt And so they could do, roller skates. And so they could do their business very quickly. And it was just like a disaster. So Sodom and Gomorrah wasn't really so far-fetched.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, Harvey Cox wrote his famous book, The Sector City, in 1963. And many of people applied that to New York City. That, well, New York is the secular city, and in fact, religion was in the retreat. That at least since the 1950s, there have been cries that religion was, in deep trouble. In fact, the invitation to Billy Graham in the night for the 1957 Billy Graham Crusade read from the council ministers and from the Catholic Church that the faith in New York was dying. Now, at that time, I think that was maybe overstating it, but at any rate, there was this sense that churches were on the churches and synagogues, which were the main religions, were in the retreat. And in 1975, the New York Times ran a series about how bad off religion was in the city, and did a series, a very good series, I think it was in August 1975. And so there was this, the secular city seemed to apply. But what happened is, and this is one of, and I know you, one of the things that surprised me as we did our journey, because we started compiling data when religious groups, churches and synagogues and so forth were founded. It's absolutely true that the number of net number of churches around in the 50s and 60s didn't seem that it was negative. It was going down. The amount of new churches that were being founded in the 50s and 60s were below replacement. That is, there were more churches disappearing than being started. And but the city in mid-70s decided that we either had to give up or have a, try to find our way back. Well, they elected a new mayor, Mayor Koch, they did some other things politically and economically and socially, and also unknown to everybody, in 1978, you see a switch in the number of, and I'm going to talk about evangelical churches because that's the ones we compile the most detail about, the number of Protestant and evangelical churches, the numbers that were being founded. It's quite distinct. From 1950 to 1978, the number of churches founded per year was, new churches. It increased the number of, it was just a minuscule percent. And each year, maybe 0.5% of the churches were new churches, or 0.6% at the most. So it was very small. Now, that's a big number in New York, but it was, small percent. It was not replacement value.
Right.
And then in 1978, that popped up to 1.2 to 1.6% church founding a year. That is the number of new churches in that population for each year was increasing by 1.2 to 1.6%. And it kept going up. And so that was an unknown. None of the churches realized that was happening. None of the synagogues knew it was happening. But it was happening. And it was starting to increase. And in 2000 brought only the World Trade Center bombing did have some big impact, and the church growth of surprising me, I will say, grew, the number of new church plantings went up to 2.1% a year, which translates to about 130 to 160 new churches a year.
Yeah, that does sound like a very small percentage, and I think people would say, 2%, that's not that big a deal, but it adds up, compound interest.
Yeah, and that's really very, very fast for the number of new churches. You know, that's one thing I think that, and you're right, compound interest. And what happens is, as you increase your space, the size, the number of churches, that 2% starts getting bigger and bigger and bigger in real numbers.
Yeah.
And because those 2% are added to the pool, and then, of course, you got 2% of those. And so it gets bigger and bigger. And in fact, a lot of the statistical understandings of church growth and church decline sometimes are it's sometimes hard for people to report them accurately because they see a small percentage. You know, it looks like a small percent. But in fact, that's a really quite significant and big percent, and in New York it was unprecedented. There was at least for 100 years, we think, there was a sort of a census back in 1890s, early 1900s, not as complete as ours, but, and then there was an attempt in the 1930s, again, not quite as complete. Not nearly as complete as ours, but it was actually, for certain neighborhoods, it was pretty good. And there have been growth spurts and growth declines in those periods, but this was really unprecedented. And what happens is, of course, the compounding, it ends up, starts to look like it's accelerating, but and it did accelerate, but really part of the impact of acceleration was that it was compounding. And you see this in other countries, like in Brazil, which is has a pretty large evangelical Protestant population now. But, you know, at first it was that's a small percent 30 years ago. But the growth rate was always the number of churches being was pretty high, but it was such a small percent that didn't catch anybody's attention. And
some of the things that people often forget is that the early history of Christianity, the growth rate was only about 3 to 5% a year. And you think, well, that's not very much. But over the course of several hundred years, it just leads to an exponential explosion of people there. And I think to some extent we're seeing this in New York City. Let me ask you a little bit about this project and how you actually did this, because I'm reading from your website here, and you went live with this on July 9th, 2010, and you must have been doing some research and investigations prior to that, so you had some content to release on that day. On your website, you talk about your project. The mission is to explore, document, and explain the great religious changes that are taking place in New York City, which we just talked about here. You further write about your mission, and I love this description, by the way. You say, quote, "We are like the animators at Pixar Studio. They are pushing constantly to increase the ability to digitally increase the details in animation. The more small, invisible to the eye details that are included, the more that the eye unconsciously sees the animation as having a supple, natural reality. On the big picture screen, you may not be able to see the nose hairs, but their presence is processed by the mind into a feeling of naturalness. We too hope to paint the city picture, the thick faith details of the city, so that people will see the natural spiritual excitement of the city," unquote. Again, it's a great description of what you're doing, because looking at your website, and what it seems that you're doing is that you get up one morning, maybe this is June 2010, you say, I'm going to take my camera, I'm going to take my digital recorder and a notebook, and I'm just going to walk out into the city. There's 6,000 some odd miles of road out there, and we're just stepping out there day one. What was it like the first day? Did you have a plan of this is what we want to look at, or just
let's go out in the city, buy a hot dog, and see what hits us in the face.
Well, we did have a certain part of a plan. We know we wanted to do it by community district because a lot of the data is by community district. And there's 56 community districts in the city. And those are roughly, those are neighborhoods, though sometimes the borders are not too accurate. But a lot of your city data and the cities are organized around those community districts. So it's very easy for us to do that. And also that way we can keep track better. We had some experience. I have quite a bit of experience of doing surveys of religious folk in New York City. And so I knew some questions we really wanted to capture that would help us give us a understanding. And we also developed, and I can't really tell you exactly when we developed our four questions. We have four sensitizing questions. Anthropologists like to say these are sensitizing questions. As journalists, we think there are four questions that really open things up and start to give you all sorts of avenues to find out things. Those four questions are, what's unique or special about your religious organization? You know, how is it different from other organizations? Sometimes that's a too cold a question, so you follow it up with, if you said, Tony, you should come to our synagogue. Why would you tell me I should come? So that gives you right away an impact, an insight into how do the leaders think that what they're doing is significant and unique, what they're trying to sell people, or to attract people, or to embolden people. And also tells you, are they very clear about what they're doing? Some are quite sharp and know exactly what they're doing, and it reflects in all aspects of the organization. Others are not so clear. And then sometimes they'll have a sort of a list, and as you're talking about it, of course, you get into the things they're excited about. And pretty quickly, you get into the heart of the church or synagogue or mosque where the heart beats. And second, we ask them, what kind of impact are you making on your neighborhood or your people? And that's sort of a theoretical question that says, are they changing New York? Because we believe we're going to find out what kind of impact they're going to have. And then that's sort of theoretical. That's what they say they do. And then we ask them a third question is, well, can you give me an example in the last 2 weeks of where that change, that impact has taken place, a specific example? And that tells you whether, it's really happening, or it gives you usually an access to a great story about somebody's life impacted. And then finally, we ask them to put on the big picture hat. And that hat is, if you were mayor of New York, how would you change New York?
Mm-hmm.
And this question actually goes back to a column I wrote for the Wall Street Journal called The Pentecostal City some time ago, I can't remember. But I raised the question is, what are the Pentecostals and the other evangelical types, what do they mean by the future of New York? Will we have Rosie Gomez as the mayor of New York someday, who is a Pentecostal preacher and then a politician as a second career? And what will that mean? And I went to find that out. And I think people in the city won't find that out. And also, it is somewhat of bringing the religious and non-religion to the table and see that, they have a lot of the same desires about the city, or the same thoughts about the city, or even the same ignorances about the city as each other have. So those are four questions, and we designed a questionnaire with that in multiple languages that sort of goes over those issues plus some basic data, like when your organization was founded, how many attend on a worship service on a typical last Sunday or Saturday, and stuff like that. And then that's another way we check the answers. We
and we also asked them, you know, what's the three most active or biggest ministries or activities they do. And some things like that are sort of cross-checking back and forth, letting us understand the dynamics of their answers. And so we did have that. We also knew we wanted to have a different style of reporting, but we didn't develop that right away. We call it sympathetic objectivity, and I'll talk to you about that later. But it's a different way of doing reporting than taught in most journalism schools. And
tell me what that is now though, because I think I know what you mean by that term, sympathetic objectivity. Well, but I fill it in.
The background is, of course, big debates are: is there objectivity, and should we want it, and is it even gettable? Then second is opinion, really a subjective views all we have. And how do you approach the other person? And most journalists learn a trinity that starts with skepticism, that basically you should be skeptical about what people tell you, and you start there. Then objectivity, that is, you arrive at facts. And then at the end, you may have sympathy or empathy with a person. But you don't have that at first, because unless you're just sort of feigning it in order to make them like you so they'll tell you stuff, you don't have that at first, because after all, that's got to be based on your skeptical arrival at facts. And problem with that is it's a very distancing way of relating to people. It's based on the investigative journalism model. If you look at the Pulitzers are mostly awarded to investigative journalists projects, because that's seen as the highest journalism. Well, we argue, no, it's not the highest journalism. It's an important journalism, and I've done that, but it's not the highest. The highest form is the journalism that helps build the strengths of your community, that helps build the strength, the well-being of the people in your community. It may involve investigative journalism, because maybe corruption is sapping the will and the vitality of the community, but most reporting is not about investigation. Most reporting is about what interesting things people are doing.
Mm-hmm.
Helping people, or worshiping together, or doing things, innovating things. So the model that journalism schools teach is not the model that really happens out there in the world. But it does create a hostility, particularly in the religion area, a hostility between the journalist and the religious, because the journalist, as one Laurie Goodstein at a talk she gave this week. She's a wonderful journalist for the New York Times, but she buys in this model. She says, what gets me up in the morning excited is accountability journalism, holding religious people to account for their misdeeds. That's what she needs. It's investigative journalism, and she's done some great investigative journalism on, you know, the abuse scandals in the Catholic Church and in the Orthodox Jewish community in Brooklyn in the last year. And those are terrific community services. But I would think that what should get us up in the morning is, how are we making our community a more compassionate, a more loving, a more prosperous, a more caring community, which may involve accountability journalism. So we start off with a different trinity. And most journalists may see some things here they recognize, but then don't usually put it together this way. We start off with sympathy or empathy. That is, we want to know the people we talk to, what is the most greatest story, the best story, the most important thing, the most innovative thing, the most interesting thing that they're doing that the rest of us in New York should know about. And we want to tell that part of the story in a way that the secular and the other religious folk from different faiths can say, you know, that's an interesting idea. I think I'll do it. I learned from that. That's what we want to do. We believe everybody has a great story if we can find it as a reporter. But second, we want to be objective, and we believe that despite all the arguments about objectivity, everybody acts as if objectivity exists, and we actually believe it exists, but people that say it doesn't exist actually act as if it does in reporting, because they say, you know, you got to get your facts right. You know, all of this stuff about fact-checking is, which is, you know, bogged down in controversy, but everybody has to act as if there's objectivity. And we believe that if the person says we got a great youth program, and they only have one youth in the whole church in the program, we're going to report that.
Yeah.
That's the objectivity. Now, normally we won't report it with criticism. We'll just let our audience decide. We just believe the audience can see if you say they have a great youth program, and then we say we interviewed the one youth in the program. Actually, you don't have to make a big criticism. It's already there. People are not dumb. They can pick that up. Now, sometimes you need to guide people critically to some conclusions. And so a third, we put criticism or skepticism at the end of the process. So we start with empathy and sympathy. And we believe that really we work very hard to really sync with the people. And we believe we actually can sink into a very deep level very quickly with people. We've learned how to do that. And then you move to objectivity and then to skepticism. Now, that's where we differ, but we developed that over time, and we came to that after a little while of working. We realized that's what we were doing, and we started thinking about it, and we coined a word maybe 2 years ago called sympathetic objectivity.
I do like that term, and how you discussed what Lori Goldstein was talking about, or holding religions accountable for their misdeeds. That style of journalism often sets up this very antagonistic relationship with religion, and I think it colors the way that religion and religious life in America and around the world is really reported. Whereas your vision of it saying, you know, listen, you guys do misdeeds, but you also do very interesting things. I think it opens the door to seeing both the positive and negative aspects. And you do hold people accountable for their misdeeds just by saying, you know, religions do a lot of good things, but they have pimples and blemishes and scars, and we're going to point those out as well, too. So, and definitely get this flavor of that on the website, Journey Through New York Religions.
By the way, it's Lori Goodstein. If I said Goldstein.
Oh, Goodstein. That's my bad. Lori Goodstein.
Well, anyway, we want to get her name. She's a really fine reporter, and we love what the New York Times does. But I think that, they see themselves as upholding the classic journalism standards, which is very admirable. But those classic standards, I think, got us into trouble. Like you said, that, and like we say too, that it distanced ourselves, and it. And also, it starts off, and it probably contributes to people saying, oh, religion's not that relevant or interesting to me, you know, and sometimes religion reporters get on all the details of the latest conference or something, and people don't really care about that.
Mm-hmm.
What they care about is what's news we can use,
mm-hmm.
what's all cool, what's exciting, and by starting with sympathetic objectivity, we say we create cool religion news,
mm-hmm.
exciting religion news, as well as, you know, accountability.
Yeah.
It
not only points out the problems, I think we learn by seeing problems and then taking corrective action, but we also learn by seeing things that go very well, things that are happening correctly. And I know a lot of our churches out here, they learn not only by mistakes have been made in the past, but look at somebody else's youth groups or something and say, wow, that's really interesting. I want to do that too. Yeah.
Quickly, I know you asked what did we do. So we got out in January of 2010, and we first went to Staten Island. I hired Melissa Kimiotti, who became our deputy director and now assistant editor, to go with me out to Staten Island. And very quickly, we got there in late January, and then very quickly in February, we ran into the biggest snowfall in recent history in New York.
Yeah.
And so we did our first journey through this massive snowfall, and we come out to this church that was surrounded by snow. I mean, it was like 4 or 5 feet. You know, it's huge. And we decided we're going to go out, you know, like the post office, rain, sleet, snow, we're going to go. And nobody's at the church, but I noticed a house next door. I think this was an Alliance church. And so we go through the snow. There was no shoveling. So we waded through the snow to the house. I said, you know, I bet this is the pastor's house, because it looked like the properties were contiguous. And let's go knock on and see if it is. So we knock on, and this guy puts his head out of the second floor and says, who is there? And I said, well, it's, you know, Tony Carnes, Melissa Kimiotti. We had one other person with us. And, you know, we're a journey to New York City religion. And the guy says, oh, you're Tony Carnes from Christianity Today.
Mm-hmm.
I can't believe you came to my steps on this day where nobody can get to anywhere. You're Tony Carnes? And I said, yeah, we really like to talk to you.
Oh, that's
and
great. Yeah, that's one of those rewarding times, right?
Yeah, yes. So he invites us in, the wife comes out, and so they make us, you know, some hot chocolate. And he said, well, I can't believe you're out, because we're not going out today. And I says, well, you know, we talked about, we asked him what, you know, a little bit. He actually had a whole history of Staten Island religion. He was quite knowledgeable. He was a great interview. And terrific guy. And so that was, and right after the snow left, a couple days later, we were in central Staten Island and at the biggest mosque, one of the biggest mosques in New York City, and they had a children's a big school there, and it was just amazing. The imam just took us in, and he allowed us to film. I mean, we just showed up, you know. He allowed us to film. He did a great interview, and I said, "Well, I don't understand all of the you know, the bowings, the prostrate, and what you say." And he said, well, can I demonstrate for you? We'll go into the mosque, and I'll demonstrate all the moves and the prostration and praying, and I'll tell you about that. I says, well, can I film it? And he said, oh, sure.
Mm.
And so we did that, and it was a wonderful experience, a great photographically, it was great. The lighting was just perfect. And the children were really terrific. Kids are very photographical, and they had all sorts of posters and stuff and artwork they were working on. And so that was sort of our experience. Very quickly, we went through on that first day, that was probably the end of January, we went through blizzard soon after. Well, that wasn't on the first day, but right at the very first, we went through a blizzard. We went through like 25 places a day. We found out that we could actually get access to, you know, people when they found out, and when we talked, sat down, talked with them, we could do reporting and discover things that, frankly, I never knew about. I know I've been here a long time, and I didn't know anything about these things.
Mm-hmm.
And so we started to say, "Oh, wow, there's a lot here, and there's a lot going on." I was surprised, and one of the biggest surprises is how past religion had grown in North Staten Island. I thought it, you know, I didn't really know much about Staten Island. It's an island off Manhattan and Brooklyn. I got to tell you, I didn't know too much about Staten Island. But it turned out there were, you know, like 300 or so religious sites in North Staten Island. And frankly, it surprised everybody in Staten Island. They had no idea. Because for example, the evangelical churches gave me a list of the churches they had. On the whole of Staten Island, it was like 20 or 30 some odd churches. And in South Staten Island, we found, you know, double that number because there were African churches. There was a very interesting church of Mexicans who come from Mexico. They didn't speak English. And I tried out my, not so good, we had Spanish questionnaires, and I had a little Spanish, and that didn't work because they spoke Mayan.
Wow.
And so the woman that I started to interview and reduced to sign language calls the pastor, who did speak English and Spanish. And in addition, and also one of the Mayan languages. And this is a Mayan Pentecostal church. And well, they weren't on anybody's list, you know. And they kept their little church. It's a small church, storefront, I would think you would say. Just immaculate inside. It was beautiful. And I thought, wow, they are so proud of this. And yet, very humble. Nobody knows they're there. Not even the religious groups that are there that know what's going on, they've never heard of this. And I also discovered in Staten Island that we could actually use religion reporting to get into the big stories of New York.
And I want to hold off on those big stories because we're running a little bit short on time here, and I want to have you back on the show to talk about a lot of the things that we see on your website. This has been a great discussion of how this project got going. And again, I'm going to urge people to go to the A Journey Through New York City Religions website, which we'll link up there. And it is, if you have any kind of ADHD that you just like to pull in lots of information from all over the place, this is actually the place to go because it's just so much is sitting there. One thing I do want to ask you as we leave off here, and again, we'll have you back on the show to talk about some specific stories, but to take a big overview, we mentioned Harvey Cox's The Secular City a little bit earlier in the interview. And we noted that a lot of people think that religion is fading from the big cities on the East Coast and on the West Coast and from New York City in particular. So in your 3 years on this journey, literally looking into the nooks and crannies, you know, talking to people from snowstorms and being invited into mosques, what has been the big takeaway that you've learned about religion and society in general?
Well, faith is certainly not fading away in the big cities, and in New York, it's growing. We say that New York is now a post-secular city. It's not the New Jerusalem or the New Mecca, but it is not the secular city or Sodom and Gomorrah anymore. Most people know it's not Sodom and Gomorrah anymore. It's a safe city compared to a lot of cities around the United States. But it's not the secular city. There's too much religious sites going on. So that's one thing. The big picture is a lot of the any place where you have lots of people in movement, that is migrants or immigrants, migrants from the United States or immigrants, or people moving around in the city, what happens is people have lots of unsettledness, and as part of their sort of assimilation into settledness, they start looking around and say, well, what do I believe about life? What is the settlement I want to go into? And that's a religious moment. Mm-hmm. And so any place around the world where you have lots of movements of people or unsettledness caused by disaster or something else, you will have people asking religious questions. They may not always give religious answers, but they are definitely will ask those religious questions. And New York is the unsettled city where two-thirds immigrants and their children. We add 500,000 people a year to New York City. Now, we lose 400,000 people a year, so we're not growing as fast, but that million change, almost 900,000 change of people, if you add those two together. The older people, there's some people leaving, and then the new people come. It's a huge amount of change. And those are religious moments. And New York is a place of a lot about the future, I think, of the United States. More so than it's maybe not the only future. Some people say there's a rise of nuns. But in fact, New York has fewer nuns than proportionally than the rest of the country. And I would say the nuns are really nominal. People that were nominally religious now answering none. I think there's not quite so big a change there. But and you also get a lot of issues coming up in New York that I think you'll see in other places. The second generation people will be asking, do we continue our parents' faith? The same way. And we find that in New York, our generation of leaders that started this religious effervescence are now moving into the retirement phase. So the question is, will their successors to people like Tim Keller or A.R. Bernard, who are pastors of big churches here, will their successors be as successful? We don't know. New York City is also changing its nature. Bloomberg says New York's a luxury product, that is, we're the luxury city, that is, we're looking to have more rich people and more high value added industries. I would say, is that going to be, are we going to have a class-driven elitist viewpoint, which is affecting a lot of thinking in even religious groups? That you took a look at all the leadership programs in seminaries around the country, and almost all of them focused only on the elite. Nobody talks about faith and work among the working class. So that's going to be an issue in New York, and it is an issue. And because what really the city, I believe, is not a luxury city. New York is becoming a city of sustained values. Now, sometimes those sustained values are products that are expensive to produce, like new digital technologies, new software, new media, things like that, like the journey. And so you have to provide, because they're more expensive, you have to provide values that will last longer, that have more impact, that worth paying more money for. But I don't believe that means we're becoming the luxury city, though that's part of it. I believe that the growth of religion here shows that we're also the city of lasting values, that we're not, which includes luxury items, not right there, of course, but that people are looking for things that last and have more impact on their lives. And I think that's actually going to be true around the world in cities that have lots of population changes. And even in Europe, we're beginning to notice that the cities that have lots of population migration and immigration to them, migration being within the country and my immigration or within the EU, and my immigration being from outside the European Union, is that you're beginning to see fast religious growth from a small base, but relatively fast religious growth and innovation. And it's become so fast in some cases, like Muslims in Paris and so forth, that it's causing a lot of discomfort. And I think that's true around the country here also. Places that are not changing very fast, and peoples are not moving in and not moving in and out very much, their religious growth is going to be low or even negative. Now, there are other trends going on. There's the rise of the new secularist and so forth, and I think those are all, nothing inevitable in this world. But New York shows a different picture, and to understand what's going on in New York will help us, I think, to understand many of the cities around the country.
Well, I think that's a great place to leave off here as we run out of time, and to think about New York as a microcosm for what is going on in many other places around the world. We definitely are going to have you back, because I do want to open up the box that is New York and peer into it a little bit more closely. But your insights about the changing nature of religion in New York City and in the world, and that we are moving into a post-secular world rather than a secular world, is a very interesting observation, and one that I think scholars and journalists need to take very seriously. So, Tony Carnes, I want to thank you for being on Research on Religion.
Well, thank you. I learned a lot from the way you do your program, and thank you for the privilege.
Thank you for listening to Research on Religion. To learn more about today's topic, participate in a discussion about what you've heard, or browse other podcasts, please visit our website at www.researchonreligion.org. And if you like what we're doing, please tell a friend. We'd appreciate the company. See you next week.